Should NATO impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine? As Russia intensified air attacks, President Volodymyr Zelensky repeated his call. But the Western military alliance says blocking airspace would escalate the war. So who's right? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is intensifying with air attacks on civilian areas. Artillery shells destroyed several buildings around the capital, Kyiv. At least two bodies were pulled from the rubble of this apartment block. Russian air raids on Sunday killed at least 35 people at a military facility near the border with Poland. That was the largest attack on western Ukraine since the invasion began. Homes and hospitals in Kharkiv and Mariupol have also been hit. Russia denies targeting civilian areas. Ukraine's president says the attacks show why NATO needs to impose a no-fly zone to protect civilians.
And now I repeat again, if we do not close our skies, it is only a matter of time before Russian missiles fall on your territory, on the territory of NATO, and on the homes of citizens of NATO countries.
Members of Parliament of NATO member Estonia are the first to demand a no-fly zone. Some or all aircraft would be banned from flying over certain regions. Any pilots violating the order risk being shot down. No-fly zones have to be enforced by military means. NATO could end up engaging directly with Russian warplanes, making the alliance direct participants in the Ukraine war. NATO and the U.S. previously imposed no-fly zones when only one side had a powerful air force, such as in Iraq and Bosnia in the 1990s, as well as during Libya's civil war in 2011. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests from Kyiv, Halina Yanchenko, a member of the Ukrainian parliament and deputy head of Ukraine's parliamentary majority. From Brussels, Robert Pistel, a senior fellow at the Casimir Pulaski Foundation in Poland. He's also a former NATO official. And from Perth in Australia, Alexei Moravyov, associate professor of national security and strategic studies at Curtin University. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Halina, let me start with you today. You and I spoke a little over 2 weeks ago on this program. At that time, you were calling for a no-fly zone. What does it mean to you today that despite repeated calls from President Zelensky and so many others in Ukraine, officials in NATO have continued to refuse to impose a no-fly zone?
Listen, I will tell you what no-fly zone means for Ukrainian innocent citizens. And it means thousands of innocent Ukrainians, women, children, older people will be safe. You know that the crimes that Russian occupation troops are now committing in Mariupol and many other cities, but Mariupol, the situation in Mariupol is the worst. Today, deputy mayor of Mariupol reported that 20,000 civilians were killed in Mariupol only. 20,000 people. Do you imagine that? Do you imagine the scale of these crimes of Russian troops in Ukraine? And they hit Mariupol heavily from air. They hit it from aviation. They hit it with its grads, tornadoes, and stuff like that. They send missiles to the peaceful cities of Ukraine. 20,000 innocent Ukrainians killed in only one city. And this is all happened because West and NATO countries are not ready, because they fear. I don't know what they fear. Don't they fear thousands of people being killed? But because they still fear to implement no-fly zone in Ukraine, the crimes against humanity, the murders of thousands of civilians are going on a daily basis. I'm in Ukraine, in Kyiv, and I should tell you that it is horrible. We are going through a nightmare. Many cities of Ukraine are going through a nightmare on a daily basis. We hear missiles from our windows on a daily basis. This is the thing that you can't get used to. This is the nightmare that we live in. And no-fly zone will definitely help to stop these crimes of Russian troops that they commit and keep committing in Ukraine. This is what no-fly zone means. And we believe, we believe that no-fly zone should be implemented. Otherwise, the world will not be a safe place to live anymore. If one country, if one crazy dictator called Putin can send his troops to another country, a sovereign, peaceful, democratic country, to start kill civilians, then world is not a safe place anymore. And that is why citizens all over the world and politicians should actually start acting, well, more actively.
Robert, you heard what Helena had to say there about all that's going on throughout Ukraine. We know NATO's position, which is that if they were to try to implement a no-fly zone, they believe that could spark a wider conflict. Let me ask you, how much risk is there, from your perspective, that attempting to implement a no-fly zone over Ukraine would spark this far more dangerous conflict?
Yes, I mean, first of all, my heart goes out to Helena and all the Ukrainians. It's a tragic, it's a barbaric attack that they are experiencing. And it's just, you know, Russia has put itself beyond the pale. Let's just stress this. I'm a former NATO official, so I can speak my, you know, I'm speaking in a private capacity. I mean, if it was up to me, first of all, I would not put the no-fly zone concept, you know, off the table. Right. I would consider it more carefully, perhaps, you know, in terms of maybe a partial no-fly zone concerning certain areas. Mariupol is an absolutely, you know, the most urgent example. I mean, first of all, there is nothing in international law which would kind of make this such a move illegal. Ukraine has the right to self-defense. It has the right to ask other countries, you know, to help. And also, you know, even Russian hypocrisy of the regime, you know, Kremlin, as they're not even calling it a war. There is also, you know, the right to protect. Doctrine enshrined in UN documents. The problem is, however, that right now, you know, there is no consensus in NATO. And it's, you know, you have to ask these questions, frankly, in the capitals, particularly in Washington, but also in major European capitals. You know, when, for instance, my country, Poland, has offered quite a generous offer, you know, for free, over 20 fighter planes. There was a number of countries in, again, Western European countries who said, no, that's a bad idea, even though nobody was asking them to actually provide anything. This is the reality. Now, having said all this, you know, it is true, one has to be, you know, quite sort of direct about this. You know, no-fly zone would mean war with Russia. It's as simple as that. Would bring, it's not just about sending a few planes here and there, it's about neutralizing the actual potential which Russia is using. I mean, for example, the attack on Avarif, which is very close to the Polish border, took place, from the Russian territory, apparently, right? So it would mean actually neutralizing, you know, a lot of infrastructure and perhaps even attacking Russian, Russian planes, mm-hmm. both in Ukraine and maybe Russian. So, you know, this is very, very serious stuff because, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking about the potential World War III. And I can understand, the reasoning provided by a lot of leaders in NATO countries. And you need, as I said, consensus. You cannot have no-fly zone, you know, done by a few countries. But at the same time, the moral case for doing more than it's being done today mm-hmm. is growing stronger every hour, not even every day, every hour.
Alexei, you must have heard Robert there talk about the fact that if this escalates, you could have World War III on your hands. From your perspective, is there a chance that NATO could reverse its decision, that they could establish a no-fly zone? What would need to happen in order for that to occur?
Look, I mean, one of the ways how it can be done, first of all, we need to talk about practicalities. Even if NATO would hypothetically decide to introduce the no-fly zone now, it will be it will face certain operational limitations. It will be limited by the operational range of its aircraft, which will have to operate from NATO airfields, because if they will try to deploy their assets inside Ukraine, they will be designated as targets by the Russian military. So in order to not to create more escalation and certainly create this threshold beyond which the conventional phase of the war can become an unconventional phase of the war, I think one way or another, it has to engage in some sort of a consultation and dialogue, as absurd maybe, as hypocritical as may sound, with Moscow about introducing, as the previous speaker just mentioned, perhaps a partial no-fly zone, for example, in the first instance, or western parts of Ukraine, whether it's manageable from the logistical perspective and where there is still limited use of Russia's offensive air power. And that may create a degree of sort of division of responsibilities over Ukraine, again, as horrible as it may sound, because we're in the middle of a human catastrophe there and a disaster, a sovereign country being attacked by a much larger country and a more formidable military power. Mm-hmm. But if we're not talking about really escalating the confrontation and not spilling the conflict beyond Ukrainian territory, it can be done, but it has to be done in some sort of through some sort of a consultation, communication, mm-hmm. and that may not be possible right this moment because, as far as I understand, all formal communications between Russia and NATO has been suspended, if not terminated for good.
Helena, I saw you shaking your head. I know you want to jump in. I'm going to let you. I also want to ask you about a point that both Robert and Alexei raised, and there have been growing calls for perhaps the establishment of this idea of a limited no-fly zone, perhaps in the west of the country. Is that something that would be acceptable to Ukrainians?
Well, first, I would like to ask Alexei to stop Putin's narrative. This is not confrontation. This is not crisis. This is war with thousands of civilians killed. You should realize that. And you should not use Putin's narrative, because Putin's narrative kills. It kills real people in Ukraine. And you have no obligation. You should not commit the crimes in the media. Second thing, no. Partial no-fly zone is not working. What are you talking about? This is like what? Let us save people in one region and Putin and Russian occupation army can kill people in all other regions? Is that what you suggest? Can you imagine, do you even imagine what you are talking about? Again, let me remind you that 20,000 civilians, meaning women, children, older people, other civilians, were killed only in one city, in Mariupol. People are stuck there with no food, no water, no medication. People are dying because they can't get a treatment. People with diseases, with cancers, with diabetes, they can't get treatment and they are dying. Children, imagine that, children on European continent are dying because of dehydration. They don't have water to drink and they die. Do you imagine that? Do you imagine going through such a things? And then we see experts and, politicians talking that no-fly zone is not something that we should discuss now. Let's think about it later on, when another dozen of Ukrainians will be killed, when another million of Ukrainians will become refugees. Is that what you are talking about, really?
Helena,
what we should discuss?
Helena, may I ask you, if NATO continues to refuse to establish a no-fly zone, what else would Ukraine like to see in the form of assistance? If they continue to refuse that?
NATO is the biggest disappointment of this year. NATO is a total disappointment. It's an organization which cannot protect anyone, which cannot protect even its own countries. And we should realize that. We should not look at NATO. We should actually communicate and request for help for certain countries, which realize that Putin and Russia is a threat. Putin and Russia is a threat for the whole world, for global security. In the majority of European countries, in their, you know, strategic documents, it's already said, it is already said for years that Russia is a threat for global security. It is a threat for European security. And nowadays we see it all. We see that they kill people in Ukraine. We see that Russians, like, we have thousands of witnesses like that, that Russian soldiers are going into residential buildings, dragging people from their apartments and shot them dead on their yard. This is what we are going through. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine this experience? Can you imagine how many more years after we finish this war, after we win this war, for how many more years we should treat our people so they can recover from this stress? Do you imagine that? And we still discuss when and who should impose no-fly zone? I think it's time for certain
countries, alliance,
to take this responsibility.
Helena,
this is not acceptable. It's a shame.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Helena. We are starting to run out of time. I need to ask Alexei a question here. Alexei, you talked about the feasibility, perhaps, of a limited fly zone. I want to ask you about how difficult it would be to achieve an expansive no-fly zone throughout the whole of Ukraine.
Well, coming back to the point that I raised earlier, first of all, it would be difficult logistically. Just the sheer operational range of NATO aircraft would require a different sort of proposition. Deploying, for example, seaborne assets in the Black Sea would be impossible given the operations and the operational activity of the Russian Black Sea fleet and the fact that the Russians effectively control the entire Black Sea maritime theater. Trying to neutralize Russian defensive posture in Russia will automatically be treated by Moscow as the declaration of war on Russia. And in the current circumstances, given the fact that NATO has three nuclear armed states, that may premeditate the escalation of the conventional conflict to a nuclear phase. Again, no one knows whether Putin will press the button or not press the button, but certainly the decision makers in Brussels, the decision makers in Pentagon would not be at risk of entertaining the option, what if he will not press the button, because everyone who is serious and who knows the business of strategic and defense planning tends to operate from what worst case scenario upwards rather than from optimistic scenario downwards. So given the current state of complete mistrust, given the current state of countries not listening to one another, and certainly Russia and the West being on worse terms, I mean, the current situation is much worse than the darkest years of the Cold War confrontation. I think NATO is simply risk avoiding. And by doing that, I certainly completely agree with Helena. It's doing industrial damage to its reputation. It's actually undermine its credibility as the world believes to be the most powerful defensive alliance. When it doesn't have the political will to challenge Russia over Ukraine after years of sidelining with Ukraine, after years of providing military assistance to Ukraine, after years of giving promises to Kyiv about eventual membership in its defensive structure, and with EU providing similar sort of promises with the eventual membership in the EU. And now it seems to be falling apart simply because the Russians decided to undertake kinetic action, which is obviously unwarranted aggression against a sovereign nation. It really, first of all, right, undermines European confidence in their own strategic affairs. It undermines, I think, European confidence in the United States as the private security guarantor on one hand. On the other hand, it certainly provides generals in Moscow with additional confidence in exercising more lethal force because they can see that NATO is, Alexei, simply too scared to challenge them.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Alexei. Again, we are starting to run out of time. I need to ask Robert a question. Robert, I saw you reacting. It looked like you wanted to jump in, so I'm going to let you do that. But I also want to ask you about the fact that the parliament of Estonia has become the first to demand a no-fly zone of a NATO member state. Do you think that there's going to be more pressure from NATO member states to try to impose a no-fly zone?
Yes, I mean, you know, this is, by the way, I was shaking my hand because I now part company with Alexei, because he was actually, his last remarks, he was basically repeating, you know, repeating Kremlin narrative in a more subtle way. Sorry. You know, we are much more united than, you know, the important thing is this. First of all, I tried to explain what the problem is, what, you know, but my, you know, my sympathy is with Alina, because I believe that, you know, we cannot just watch this, like, you know, 20,000 people being killed in Mariupol is enough, just, you know, to demand to do more. And I think the public opinion in our countries will grow much harder with every hour. The second point I would make, and this is where I say you are totally wrong. You're trying to portray, I mean, NATO is, you know, there is no consensus for various reasons, but, you know, the Russian armed forces are inept, ineffective, and frankly, they're a bunch of cowards because they are unable to conduct a proper military operation. They could not do it in Syria. They could only bomb innocent people in Syria. They could not conduct it in Chechnya, and they're repeating this in Ukraine. So in my view, the actual ability, if a political decision was made, by NATO, and it would have to be by NATO. Again, sorry, Alina, I'm not the one taking decisions, but if I were, my my fear, my calculation about the ability of NATO to actually impose it is much more optimistic because of the complete shambolic, you know, corrupt way. You know, we're talking about not just war crimes, but plain pillaging, which the Russian soldiers engage with. They are not able to fight openly with the Ukrainians. So in other words, if NATO decided to go with, yes, with the risk of the Third World War, de facto, you know, but I'm pretty sure that it would be able to overcome the Russian military forces. That is the reality. But again, I come back to the point. This message has to get through. It is getting through to a lot of people in different capitals, but at the same time, you know, we need to have, you know, respect the fact that, you know, there is, you know, NATO countries are democratic countries, and they all, you know, look at the situation mm-hmm. from the point of view of security of the people that they represent, and one cannot neglect this. So in other words, we are where we are today. Mm-hmm. But if Russia continues this barbaric war, who knows? You know, the public opinion may actually, you know, change the views of the people who make those decisions. At the moment, you know, the main effort has to be on helping Ukraine with defensive, with military assistance. And that is happening as we speak. And that is the most important thing that we can do right now. And other things, well, it's...
Alexei, we only have a little over a minute left. It looked like you might have wanted to respond to what Robert was saying. So I'm going to give you a chance right now.
Look, I mean, it all comes down to the point, okay, if NATO will agree on using military force to intervene, who is going to do it? I mean, clearly it's not going to be Estonia, who was the first to vote for it. So it's going to be established military powers. We also need to remember, just give me a second, please. We also need to remember that you need to give full credit to the Ukrainian military. In the context of the Ukraine's defensive posture, Ukraine right now, or at least prior to the war, deployed one of the most effective military forces, in some instances superior to some of the militaries of a number of NATO member countries. I mean, if Russia is so bad in its combat performance, well, why don't generals in Brussels make a quick decision and destroy the force that, according to you, is performing so badly? So I think you know, we need to understand the realities on the ground, and we also need to understand the complexities of the situation. And when we discuss in war, it's important that the war is discussed by people who actually understand the business of war fighting, not people who are making empty promises and who are not going to end up fighting. You are not going to go to the front line to actually confront that force. So before you simply say and make promises about destroying the force, assess it first and then make your decision. And clearly this is where NATO has been stuck with it. with that assessment.
All right, well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there today. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Halina Yanchenko, Robert Pichtel, and Alexei Muraviev. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.